We're going to bring the Environment Natural Resources. You know what this says? It says Prevention Policy Finance Committee. So we need to amend the minutes. I'm going to make a motion to amend the minutes and change the title on our committee to the Environment Natural Resources Policy and Finance Committee. It's just written wrong on the minutes. Somebody want to make a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Fabian. Discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Noted that Torkelson voted nay. We're going to start out. Let's see. I think actually a couple of members were excused yesterday. Representative Dill, Representative Cornish. Is there anybody else that we missed yesterday? We did introductions yesterday. Representative Dill, why don't we start with you? We talked a little bit about, other than just saying how many terms we've been here, maybe some things that people don't know about you, either to deal with getting up in the air or catching fish. So just a couple hints about what you could talk about.
State Representative David Dill, 7 terms. I live in Crane Lake, Minnesota on the Canadian border. Represent Coochin County, where International Falls is located, St. Louis County, Ely and the north side of Duluth, so it's a whole, almost the whole county. Lake County, where two harbors and a lot of the boundary waters is located, in all of Cook County, where Grand Marais and Lutz and Ski Hill and other amenities are located, have the most number of state parks of any district in the state. Most number of trout streams of any district in the state. We have mining, timbering, paper, and tourism in our district. So as you can well imagine, I've formerly chaired, or maybe you don't want to imagine, but I've formerly chaired these committees in the environment policy, game and fish, and things like that, and it fits well. And I tried to make one thing that I've always tried to do when I was chairman was to make my bill as bipartisan as possible. And I think in the 4 times that I've chaired the committee, or chaired a committee similar to this, that we almost always had similar numbers of Republican bills and Democrat bills, because the outdoor, at least the outdoor section, recreation section for sure, really is pretty bipartisan and not really a red or a blue issue. We get into the weeds a little on things like wetlands and mining and mitigation and de minimis and things like that, and looking forward to keep working on that stuff. So that's it.
And Representative Dill, what did you do before you came here?
Well, I've done a lot of things, but I founded an airline in Indianapolis, Indiana, and it was a good venture.
Good.
And so I've been in the airplane business for 42 years, and still am to this day, and have a Canadian fly-in fishing resort in Canada.
Yeah. Well, and an interesting story that I remember as a freshman, as we all came in, Representative Cornish will speak next, came in, the three of us came in the same class. I remember when we were introducing those of you that are freshmen, Representative Dill, they asked what was unique about you. His story was a lot more cool than mine. Mine was just that I had been bit by 3 dogs that year, door knocking. But Representative Dill had left his home on snowmobile across the ice to jump in your airplane to fly down to our meeting, if I remember the story right. So it was the snowmobile to the car to the airplane to get, and I thought you and Representative Fabian have additional challenges than I do when I'm 25 minutes away from the Capitol. So it's interesting. It's cool to see the different perspective. And why don't we move next to Representative Cornish? If you could tell us a little bit about where you've been and how you got here and all those kinds of things.
When do we have to end here? Oh, no, I just...
We have lots of time.
I'm Tony Cornish. I'm a representative of 23B. I live about 35 miles straight north of the Iowa border between Mankato and Iowa in Waseca and Blue Earth, Watonwan counties. I used to farm, and then I started in police work, then a deputy sheriff, then I was a game warden up in north, on northeast of Bemidji for 20 years, and we'll tell some stories later in the year. And after that, I retired. Then I came back as chief of police, and I'm kind of probably a right-wing conservative gun nut. I carry a lot of NRA bills, avid hunter and fisherman. Everything that I've got in my office, you see all the dead animals, either they're shot or run over. And it's one of the most photographed, accidentally ran over, no. It's one of the most photographed offices in the Capitol, they tell me, so if you get a chance to come over and see it. And this is my seventh term, and I enjoy everything about this committee, and looking forward to, I've been on it a number of times, looking forward to a lot of the issues that we're going to have. So, and I'm also chairman of the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Committee. So,
well, thank you to both of you, and I think that you're the only two that were not here yesterday. At that point, today we're going to hear from DNR Commissioner Landwehr and Assistant Commissioner Meyer. You can go ahead and come forward, Commissioner. That would be great. I think Mr. Meyer will be joining you. Oh, he is here up here, but is Commissioner? Okay. After he's done. Okay, Commissioner, welcome. Commissioner, feel free to get a cup of coffee, too, if you want. So go ahead. Welcome. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Tom Landwehr. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, and it's a pleasure to be here today. I have known many of you for many years. Thank you. I still am wrestling with technology. Those of you I don't know, it's a pleasure to meet you for the first time. By way of very brief introduction, I have been the commissioner for 4 years. Governor Dayton appointed me in 2011, but I've been in the business of conservation for about 30 years. I am a graduate of the University of Minnesota. I started out as a wildlife biologist with the Department of Natural Resources, worked for the DNR from 1981 to 1999, at which point I took a job with Ducks Unlimited. I worked for Ducks Unlimited for 5 years doing their conservation programs in Minnesota and Iowa. After 5 years, I took a job with the Nature Conservancy and worked in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota on their conservation programs in the state. So I've been doing conservation work for quite some time, very familiar with a lot of the issues, and I spend a substantial amount of time hunting and fishing throughout Minnesota. So I try to get to every corner of the state every year. So it's an honor to serve in this position. This is really the position where I see I can do the most for conservation, and it's a pleasure to work with you all, especially those who embrace that conservation vision, because we can get a lot done when we work together. So what I would like to do is give you an overview of the Department of Natural Resources and set the table for some discussions about the individual divisions that are within the department, and get into the discussions about the budget around that. Many of you know, some of you may not, the department has a huge mission. We have a very broad set of responsibilities. We have very high expectations among the stakeholders for what we should get done. And our impact is very significant across the state as well. So we have a very visible agency. We do a lot of things that we believe touch every Minnesotan, and we take that that responsibility very seriously. So this is our mission statement. We work with citizens of Minnesota to manage the state's natural resources, provide outdoor recreation opportunities, provide for commercial uses of natural resources in ways that, create a sustainable quality of life. What I'd like to paraphrase this for people is that there are certain public resources that the state of Minnesota owns, and it's not the department that owns these, it's the state of Minnesota. So, for instance, we are the primary stewards for lands owned by the state, and there are many millions of acres, including the things that grow on those, like trees, and the things that are underneath those lands, like minerals. We are responsible for the physical assets on those public lands, such as state park buildings, public water accesses, state trails. We are responsible for fish, game, and wildlife, at least the non-federal species. So non-game wildlife that fall into the state's purview, as well as the fish and game species of people hunting fish. And we have responsibility for surface and groundwaters, at least with respect to the quantity of those resources and how we allocate to the public. Through this asset base, we provide outdoor recreation, snowmobiling, ATV, state park system, hunting and fishing, obviously a variety of public recreation, outdoor experiences, as well as economic development. And we like to demonstrate that visually with this diagram. And you'll see this a lot over the years in working with the Department of Natural Resources. Our three missions, outdoor recreation, economic development, natural resource protection, have a high degree of overlap. Obviously, we manage a state forest. You get public recreation off that as well as timber. We have a huge impact on economic development, in particular in northern Minnesota, where you'll often hear about the three T's, timber, tourism, taconite. We have a role in managing all of those resources. We administer about 25% of the forests in the state. We provide about 30% of the raw material for the mills in the state, off that 25%. So we intensively manage state forests. And if you live north of 210, you know that a substantial part of the economy originates with timber, tourism, and taconite. I want to talk just briefly about our budget, just a very high-level overview to demonstrate some of the intricacies of this department. We have a very complicated revenue stream, a very complicated budget, and you'll hear some of that over the next few days. This slide, while it details expenses, it is also a good summary of the sources of revenue to the department. So you'll see that in 14 and 15, roughly 12% of the budget was from direct general, that is general funds that are directed to a specific activity. 10% is general open, and that is comprised largely of two items, one of them being payment in lieu of taxes and one of them being fire suppression. The department has a major role in suppressing fire across the state. The legislature has provided an open appropriation for that, and that is reflected in that 10%. 19% of our funding comes from the sale of hunting and fishing licenses. That's the game and fish triangle you see there, as well as federal reimbursement that comes from the Pittman-Robertson and Eagle Johnson funds that are excise taxes on sporting equipment. Natural Resources Fund is a catch-all for things like ATV registrations, OHV registrations, some of the park passes and things that people buy. This is an aggregation of small funds, most of which are dedicated to specific purposes, and you'll hear some of that detail later on. 20% very recently is from the Outdoor Heritage Fund. If you understand the legacy amendment, the Outdoor Heritage Fund is a grant-based revenue source. This is not part of our base, but every year when the Outdoor Heritage Council is soliciting projects for funding, we submit projects, and in 14 and 15, roughly 20% of our budget came from those outdoor heritage sources. I should mention as well, and we'll see this detail in a bit, a substantial part of that fund is actually passed through to other agencies. When you do an appropriations bill, it will be dollars are directed to the Commissioner of Natural Resources for a grant to Pheasants Forever, for instance. That money still shows up on our book, just like the payment of the tax, it shows up on our books, but it's actually passed through money. And then you can see there's a host of other smaller funding sources, Parks and Trail Legacy, that's Legacy Amendment, Clean Water Fund, that's Legacy Amendment as well, Environment and Natural Resources Trust, that's the earlier constitutional amendment, Special Revenue Funds, federal, and other comprise the rest of that. So a very complicated budget and made more complicated because within each of those, there tend to be smaller dedicated funds that have statutory restrictions on what they can be used for. And here is how the funding the expenditures break out by division. We have seven divisions, and I'll talk about those in a minute. These are the seven divisions in the Department of Natural Resources, and you can see where the primary expenditures are. A quarter of the funds go to fish and wildlife. That's for managing fish and wildlife populations, for managing, doing the research around those, for doing management on wildlife management areas and so on. 8% is to our Division of Lands and Minerals. For managing the mineral resource as well as managing the transactions around the land holdings that the state owns. Ecological and Water Resources, responsible for many things which we'll talk about, 14% of the budget, forestry 13%, parks and trails 21%, enforcement 7%, and then our Operations Services Division, which provides much of what you would call the backroom administrative services for the department. So the fleet services, the facilities maintenance, the HR budgeting, all of those responsibilities are grouped in one division, and that's about 12% of the overall budget. We are scattered literally all over the state. We have 200-some offices scattered around the state. This is a map of our work locations. People tend to think of our state parks as being where we are. We have 66 state parks, 9 state recreation areas. But we have forestry offices, we have fish and wildlife offices, we have enforcement stations scattered all around the state. So we really are community-based in every community in the state. And we are organized under four regions. So we have a Northwest region, a Northeast region, Southwest, and a what we call a Central region. Each of these regions has a regional director, and you can see the names of the regional directors up there. They are responsible for overseeing the collaboration among the divisions. In each region, each of those regions has a regional office. New Ulm, Bemidji, Grand Rapids, and St. Paul. We have regional representatives from each of the divisions, and the regional director makes sure that when there are conflicts between the divisions that they resolve those, and they also are the outreach person to especially elected officials in those parts of the state. There is a senior managers team for the Department of Natural Resources. It's comprised of the five people in the commissioner's office, as well as the regional directors, as well as the division directors. This is an organizational chart of the divisions in the DNR. So again, we have 7 divisions all reporting to the commissioner's office. The regional directors, the division directors, and the commissioner's office represent the senior management team for the department. Mr. Chairman, we do have most of the division directors here today, maybe all of them. I'm going to ask them to individually stand up as I call off their name, because you will be working very closely with them. We expect our division directors to be providing the testimony when you're getting into the budget stuff, and so I'd like to individually introduce them. First off, in Lands and Minerals, we have Jess Richards. Ecological and Water Resources, we have a brand new division director, Luke Skinner. Forestry, Forrest Bowe. I didn't see Forrest come in. Craig Schmidt is the deputy director for forestry. Craig was most recently the regional director for forestry in Grand Rapids. Parks and Trails division director is Erica Rivers. Fish and Wildlife director is Ed Bogus. Enforcement is Colonel Ken Swing. I don't see the colonel here, so I don't believe he's in. He's probably catching a bad guy. And Operation Services, Lori Martinson is our director for that. So as we get into the budget discussions, we will bring each of those people up that are intimately familiar with their budgets, and they can answer questions around that. The last thing I want to point out is that we just produced a new 10-year strategic plan, and I'm going to make sure you each have a copy of this if you don't already. It gives you a good feel for the overall mission of the Department of Natural Resources, the responsibilities of the DNR, some of the challenges we see facing us, and there are many, some of our strategies for dealing with those challenges, and some of the actions we intend to take. And I hope you'll find this very useful when we are meeting with you individually to talk about issues or priorities. We will be referencing this a lot, because this really is a good snapshot. It's hot off the presses of the issues that are facing us today. So we are very pleased to be able to present you with this, and hope this gives you a good understanding of our operation. Mr. Chairman, with that, there is going to be additional testimony after me, but I'm going to open it for questions.
Well, thank you, Commissioner, and I would like to give everybody an opportunity to bomb away at you, because we don't get you here as much as we'd like sometimes, and I appreciate the fact that you've got your division directors, or most of them, here this morning, so maybe some of that, if you need some help, we can get them, because I do want to respect the agency and all the agency understanding for members that I'm one that doesn't like to necessarily see all these people sitting in the audience every day, just in case we might ask a question. Commissioner, can you just, this is brand new, I think it's cool that you've got this 10-year strategic plan. Can you give us just a couple highlights, things that you're excited or nervous about that are in the plan?
You know, I think the big challenge with the department is there are so many challenges. You know, when you think of the 7 divisions, the issue areas we get into that range from, you know, aquatic invasive species to loss of grasslands to water appropriations to, terrestrial invasive species. You know, we've got some real concerns about the forest, the health of the forest. A number of things in there, and it's hard to put a finger on any one of them. Surely aquatic invasive species continues to be a concern. As you all know, the governor held a pheasant summit on December 13th in Marshall due to the concerns that we've got about the loss of habitat in the southwestern part of the state and what can we do about it collectively. We've got a lot of concerns around groundwater. We've got a couple of initiatives going on right now that you'll hear about with respect to what we call groundwater management areas. There are three of them in the state. They're areas where we've got declining resource availability for groundwater resources and increasing demand, and we need to figure out how to better allocate those resources so that we're sustainable into the future. We've got some real issues with sustaining a forest products industry. As I mentioned, the state provides 30% of the raw material to the mills. The mills still are dealing with a global economy, and as a result, they still have to go to the places that are most competitive. We need the mills. The mills provide that forest management that involves timber harvest as well as reforestation and many other aspects of silviculture. When a mill closes, we lose opportunity to maintain those forests. So we work very, very closely with the forest products industry to make sure that we can give them what we can and that we know what their needs are going forward. And mining, obviously, is a big issue as well. We've got a very healthy iron ore industry going on right now. It's probably firing on more cylinders right now than it has in several decades. But the mining that gets the attention is the non-ferrous mining, the copper-nickel mining proposed, particularly with respect to Polymet, but then two other mines coming online in the future. So that certainly how we as a state, and I say that because it's not a Department of Natural Resources issue, but how we as a state deal with those issues is going to be very important going forward. We've got a simmering situation in northwest Minnesota with respect to the Red River. There is a desire by some of the communities along the Red River to get better flood protection. And one of the proposals that's out there right now is via the Corps of Engineers is the Fargo-Moorhead diversion. It is designed to provide very substantial flood relief, and in fact it would, but in the implementation of it will also severely impact a lot of Minnesota residents who won't otherwise realize any benefit. So it's a very controversial project that we're working on right now. And Mr. Chairman, I could go on and on, but a number of big issues right now, and perhaps it'd be better to find out what your members think are important.
Well, thank you, Commissioner, and I appreciate you being here and look forward to working with you again as we deal with a number of challenging issues. I was happy to hear you night before last when I was listening to the radio on the way home on the Ron Shera show. You mentioned the problems with the boat sticker and the AIS effort. What can the department do immediately via electronically or the notices that you're sending to boat owners about the anticipation that this will get changed and get fixed so that we're dealing with AIS but we don't have this sticker, which I think has got pretty broad support, realizing that we need to change it? Is there something the department can do right now to let people know that it looks like the legislature is going to be changing this? The effective, if you could just let people know the effective date, but yet it's different than when people get the notices. You're talking to people that are boat owners, but the actual sticker goes on the trailer. So if you give us the short of that and what you can do, I'm interested in what you can do immediately, because one of my calls last night was anticipation of that issue. So thank you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for that question. And Mr. Chairman, I'm going to presume some of the members don't know what the issue is here. So if I could just briefly recap it, the legislature passed a requirement, I believe it was last year, that would kick in July of this year, that would require all trailers trailering a boat have a decal on it, signifying that the person took an online course on aquatic invasive species. The only way you can get the decal is to take this online course and you get certified and we send you a decal. The decal would go on a trailer so that enforcement people would know that owner has had that aquatic invasive species training, understands the laws, understands the impact. aquatic invasive species are one of those huge challenges we've got in the state of Minnesota because they pose such a long-term threat to, you know, our most precious resource, and that is water. And yet we're very challenged to deal with aquatic invasive species. And I'm going to focus on zebra mussels right now because that really is the thing that has got people's concern. Zebra mussels are transported largely by people, except when they're in a river or in a lake chain. They're transported largely by people, either moving boats or trailers, or in some cases docks or other lake equipment. And when you think that we have 800,000 registered boats in the state, there are 1,500 public water accesses owned by the state of Minnesota. There are three times that are privately owned or owned by other units of government. The task of trying to monitor or get our arms around directly controlling the spread of aquatic invasive species is just almost insurmountable. What we have elected to do as a state is to make sure that people know of the threat of aquatic invasive species, the threat of zebra mussels, that they know that it's their personal responsibility to make sure they're not transporting aquatic invasive species, set up education so they can find out about that, set up enforcement frameworks of their penalties if they disobey that. But ultimately, depending on the owners to take responsibility when they're moving their boats or their bait buckets or their docks. We have had an education program in place for a long time. I think last session there was a desire to make it more explicit, make it more prescriptive to the people who are moving boats as one of the vectors of moving that moving zebra mussels. We certainly acknowledge that there needs to be good education. We're still seeing 20% non-compliance in some of our boat checks coming off of accesses. And so we support the idea of education. Believe there are some good nuggets in there, Mr. Chairman, around the decal issue. Our conservation officers have said it would make their job much easier if they could pull into a boat access site and just look for the trailers and see who does or doesn't have a sticker indicating they have or haven't had the training. But the law as it was passed creates some problems. How do we, if we enforce this on the roads, what do we do about somebody coming in from Wisconsin who had no knowledge about the decal requirement and maybe isn't even going to stop in Minnesota? Maybe he's going to go to North Dakota. I know, hard to believe, but maybe they would actually be passing through Minnesota to another state. And so there are some huge problems, and Mr. Chairman, you're getting those calls. I suspect many members are getting those calls. We're getting those calls. How can we implement this? And Mr. Chairman, it is my hope and belief that we can fix that this year so that the good elements of that can be saved, but the things that are unworkable, we can get rid of. So, Mr. Chairman, directly to your question, we have a number of things that we could do in the short term. We can surely send out a news release right away advising people that there will be changes to this. So if you are intending on trailering a boat this year, just hold off for now. We can put some information on the website. But, Mr. Chairman, I would hope that to the effect that changes are made, they're done soon enough such that, you know, when people start wanting to trailer their boats, this summer, that we have given them adequate time to take the training. One last thing, Mr. Chairman, the online training program has been fully developed. We've already paid a contractor to put that together. It's virtually ready to go. And so from our standpoint, once the requirement does kick in, we are virtually ready to go on implementing.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. I just want us to, and I think you sent the right message on the radio show with Mr. Shera, that you realize it's going to change and it needs to change. Just one correction. I'm interested in changing it because we actually passed that law when I was tucked in a bill that I carried 3-4 years ago. So it was an initiative pushed by former Representative Ward, but it ended up in my bill. But it was a DNR initiative, so I, thank goodness, can't take credit for it. You get to take credit for it, Commissioner. But what we're interested in working together with you, and so whatever you can do in the short term, we do want to get it fixed prior. As you know, it's effective. It's June 30th. There may be a couple questions to this point. Is it to this point? Yes. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner, welcome. So we've been talking here in the last few minutes about changes, but I think there's a movement to repeal. And what I understand you saying, just so we're talking in plain language, you want to mend it but not end it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think there are really good elements of that concept of having trailered boats, making sure that the people who are trailing those boats understand aquatic invasive species. There is really, you know, we have talked about this both with you all as well as among ourselves to figure out the best way to make sure the people who are potentially moving aquatic invasive species have knowledge about that. And ultimately, it comes down to, well, the people trailing the boats are doing the majority of the transferring. So how do we get to those? And that concept of a trailer decal has risen as one of the best ideas.
Follow-up, Representative Hans.
So I take that as a yes, that you want to mend it but not end it. And the department does not support repeal?
That's correct.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, members, yes, that's correct.
Thank you, Representative Hanson. Follow-up?
Yeah, follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I think that's important because, as you said, we've spent millions of dollars over a generation on billboards and fact sheets and things like that. And then I think 4 years ago we had a different sticker, which I think those stickers are still in a warehouse somewhere that will never be used. They were silver and black stickers, if I remember correctly.
Right.
So we go forward and then back when there's resistance. But, you know, the cost of a lake becoming sterilized with zebra mussels where there's no more fish in it is huge. And I think one piece we passed last year was to have a voluntary program that the department was supposed to work with MnDOT with rest areas or to try to help educate out-of-state people that are passing through that they, not mandatory, not required, but to have washing stations in that for those folks who are carrying boats through that they could help them, not hurt them. So any progress on that? Or, and you don't have, if you don't have that at your fingertips, if you could share that with the committee later on.
Any comment, Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm not aware that we're proposing to do a sort of a rest stop educational effort. We certainly are trying to get the word out. The funds that we've got right now for aquatic invasive species come from two sources. One is there's a general fund appropriation, and two is there's a sticker, a part of your registration, $5 from a boat registration goes into aquatic invasive species fund, and that's $5 for a three-year registration. So we have, you know, somewhere in the range of $8 million a year for the program. It relies on really four elements. First and most important is education. Second is that we have boat inspections. We have a number of inspectors around boat access around the state. Third is we do have some decontamination units. And fourth is the enforcement. We have dedicated officers to that, dedicated time for each officer to that purpose. And that's really been our approach to date.
Representative Dill, was that to this point?
No, I just had another group of questions.
Okay, well, we'll hold that. Representative Fabian, to this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, just I want to be clear. Is the current program that's in place that will take effect July 1, is there a spot on the DNR website where people are currently going, using a credit card, paying to take this course, and then getting some sort of certification for having completed the course?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we do not have a place right now where people would pay for that course. We have the online course packet, if you will, ready to put online, but it is not live at this point.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is it your intention to not put that online until we get this situation cleared up here in the legislature?
Commissioner Landwehr.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I don't see any reason to put it online if it's going to change.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And Commissioner, that's the point I wanted to make, and I appreciate your willingness to do that. I understand where Representative Hansen's coming from, that there's good parts to this, but it's not workable the way it is right now. We've got a lot of great things. And you made the point, Commissioner, this is targeting one subset of people that we're interested in. Members, unfortunately, some of the worst cases of infestation were the movement of different things like docks, shore stations, water users. They can be irrigation contractors moving from Ossawinamakee to Whitefish with their waders and challenges like that. So there's a number of challenges not addressed by the sticker on a trailer that could be driven by anybody other than the one who actually put the sticker on. So, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, and just, you know, kind of a general FYI for people, and I'm sure that you all have constituents. I mean, if we do move forward with some plan, which, you know, I get that, but there's a lot of people that don't have internet connection, and they are not online as much as all of us are. There's a lot of people out there in a lot of parts of the state, and I'm sure in Representative Dill's district, there's lots of people that do not have an internet connection. So we just need to proceed carefully with how we're going to do this if we expect everyone to be as connected as we are. But
thank you. We're going to start to go through the any more on that one?
Mr. Chairman,
Commissioner Langworth.
Just a little bit of additional information. Representative Hansen mentioned the other sticker that was required. That was a sticker that everybody was supposed to have in their boat, and it was informational about aquatic invasive species and the statutes. It was repealed because it was such it seemed to be such a token effort, and it was really challenging to roll out, so we repealed that. The motivation for the trailer decal was in part driven by the notion that there are a lot of people who have a lake cabin that they put a boat on that never leaves that lake. And so, yet we're requiring all boat owners now, and all resort owners, to have pay for that aquatic invasive species control, even if they are not moving those boats. And so part of the motivation for the trailer decal was to target those people who are, you know, ostensibly moving boats around and not sort of penalize the ones who are not moving boats around. But to your point, Mr. Chairman, we are aware of at least two cases where a lakeshore owner sold a dock on an infested lake that was subsequently moved to an uninfested lake and transported the zebra mussels to that lake.
Well, Commissioner, a couple of points. I don't agree that we shouldn't all pay whether you have a trailer or not. I do have a trailer for my fishing boat, but I don't have a trailer for our big boat. But you know what? We have a shore station for that boat, and we got a dock that goes to that boat. And all the time I see these shore stations sitting up for sale, and you know the requirements about the 90 days and all that. So we should all be paying. I don't agree that only the ones with trailers should pay, and I know some of my colleagues don't agree with that. And the more boats you have, the more you should pay, because the more opportunity are that you're going to be part of the challenge. Commissioner, and I want to get on, because a lot of people have a lot of questions about different things. The AIS, we will have a hearing here that will deal with all the different challenges of AIS, including the $10 million a year that's currently going to counties, and we've got some counties that don't have a clue what they're supposed to do with that money, and other counties like Crow Wing that are doing great things with this money to protect. And so we are going to have a serious discussion about that money and whether it's the best. There's not enough coordination between your agency and that money. If that money's going to go out the door, we want to go on the best way possible. So I know that you didn't have a lot of say in how that went to be, but you need more say if we're going to really have a coordinated effort and have a good discussion about that. So thank you for that. And now we'll move on to members' questions on different issues. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome. Nice to see you, Commissioner. I also concur with the chair that you know, this is a great document, your 10-year strategic plan. It's presented in a very well-organized, understandable way. And I noted on page 5 under your first goal, under changing wildlife populations, you note average warmer weather. Average warmer weather is one of the challenges. And so I think that, you know, there's so many areas under the DNR's jurisdiction where, you know, climate change has impacts. You know, there was recently a loon study about the declining loon population long term. Superior National Forest, well documented impacts there. Rising water temperatures in Lake Superior. We could go on and on. Can you talk in a little more detail about, you know, what the agency's strategies are around climate change and where you're seeing it come up and how you're responding to it?
Commissioner Langworth.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for that question. The you know, the evidence of the impacts is out there, and you know, just as an ice fisherman, I'll tell you right now, I know my ice fishing season is getting shorter over the decades, and so we're seeing some of the impacts of climate change. And there's really sort of two things that we can do to address that, sort of at the macro scale at a state agency. And one of those is to make sure that we are minimizing our contribution to greenhouse gas emissions. And we've been working through the EQB with a number of other agencies
in the executive branch to make sure that we're using renewables whenever possible, we're reducing the amount of miles we're driving, we're changing our fleet to be more energy efficient, and so we have installed a number of solar arrays across the state. We've got one of the biggest ones in the state down in New Ulm right now. We have dramatically reduced the amount number of gallons of gasoline that we're using on an annual basis, in large part by reducing the size of the vehicles, as well as promoting virtual meetings. We've shifted more to diesel because they are more energy efficient. We have done retrofitting on all of our buildings to make sure they're as energy efficient as possible. So we're taking every step we can to reduce the amount of contribution that we're making. But perhaps most more impactful is what we're doing with respect to sort of adaptation. So we talk about minimizing the contribution. We call that mitigation. We call the things that we do to adapt to climate change, we call that adaptation. So, for instance, there's good evidence that the composition of our forests will change over time. And in the absence of sort of us helping, the change may be to a composition that is less beneficial for the forest products industry. So we need to look at what are the species we want to plant when we do a reforestation project to make sure that it is providing those commercially desirable species in places where we think the composition of the forest is going to change. We're thinking more, excuse me, more and more about engineering. We just had the recent flooding up in Duluth. It affected, I believe, was in the neighborhood of 11 trout streams. We expect one of the consequences going forward to be more extreme sort of climate situations, more flooding situations. How do we re-engineer the assets that we have that are in proximity to streams to make sure that they're more resistant to damage by virtue of flooding? So we're looking at a number of adaptation strategies around that as well.
Follow
thank
up.
You. There's many Hornstein. More, thank you, Mr. Chair. I know other members have many more questions, and of course this is a very long conversation, and I just hope, you know, in the committee and as we, you know, discuss issues moving forward with the DNR, that we really put this issue front and center, because I think there's so many impacts that we have throughout the state, you know, and it's going to affect our economy, it's going to affect tourism in so many ways. So I'm glad that the agency's, you know, beginning to address this, and I hope that you'll continue to forcefully address it, and particularly in your educational materials and, you know, letting the public know, again, that this is having tremendous impact on our state and our natural resources. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, if I could offer one additional thought. One of the things in that vein, one of the things that we're trying to do is promote the use of woody biomass as a heating source. You know, there are still people who will debate whether or not woody biomass as a heating source is carbon neutral. I assert it is. It might be a longer time frame than people like. But when you burn a tree, it releases carbon dioxide that is then reabsorbed by the next generation of trees. So in the long run, the use of woody biomass is carbon neutral and beneficial to the state in many ways, because we can derive another product out of the Minnesota forests. It sustains our local economy. We have 9 wood-burning furnace manufacturers in the state that can grow that business as well. So we're looking at how we can ramp up the use of woody biomass for heating. Right now, 13% of the homes in Minnesota derive their primary source of heat from wood. We would like to increase the use of wood, and so we are installing wood burners on 2 installations, on 2 facilities in Minnesota, mm-hmm. up in the Tower Sedan area over the next year, as a way to sort of start stimulating the demand for pellets, such that we might ultimately attract a pellet manufacturer and additional demand from consumers as well.
Thank you. Representative Cornish.
excuse me, Commissioner. Well, first of all, good luck in getting the Timberwolf back on the hunting and trapping list, and your luck with the appeal. Secondly, after you did an interview in the media recently about the deer density, you took some pretty heavy hits in the comments there. Do you think that during this session or anytime soon there'll be some agreement? It seems like they're pretty far apart. This one-man army on the other side is really distant from your modules and how you figure that out. Do you think they'll be able to come together and come to some type of resolution on the deer density disagreement?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, members, you know, I think the issue right now, you know, is one that's being driven by the fact that people are not seeing deer, right? So there's disagreement about how many deer ought to be out there. And so there's no doubt people aren't seeing deer. Don't get me wrong. I'm a deer hunter myself. I've been quoted in the paper as saying it was 4 years since I have seen a deer, and I finally saw two deer this year, so I feel pretty good about that. There's concern that the deer population has been driven too low, and that is, I don't disagree with that. The background of that is that every 5 years or so, the department goes into a goal-setting process. So we determine what the population density ought to be in permit areas across the state. And if you're a deer hunter, you know we have permit areas where you apply for an antlerless permit. We set our population goals based on the public process for each of those permit areas. And so 5 years ago, predates me, we went through this public stakeholder process and said, okay, in each of these permit areas around the state, what should be the density of deer? And people looked at what it had been, you know, what the success rate had been for deer harvest, and universally decided that we should reduce the deer herd across the state. And so, again, predated me, the department took the direction and started increasing the number of antlerless permits, which is how we drive the deer population, to deliberately drive the deer population down. That was, in the last 2 years, as you all know, accompanied by two very severe winters. And so while we were deliberately trying to reduce the deer herd, we also got hit with a couple of severe winters that ultimately even led us to feeding deer last year. It was that severe. So there's no question that deer herd is below where hunters want to see it. There's no question in my mind that we need to increase the deer herd. But we still have to go through, I believe, a deliberative process to decide what the deer herd ought to be. We know that, you know, high deer populations can cause problems for landowners. And we need to balance, you know, what we can provide to the hunter with the impacts that the negative impacts they might be having. This public process will help us figure out what that outcome ought to be. So we will have, after this goal setting process, which is underway right now, for each permit area, a deer density goal. So it may be, for instance, in southwestern Minnesota, 2 deer per square mile. It may be in northern, north central Minnesota, 15 deer per square mile. We recognize that there are differences in the habitat carrying capacity for deer in those areas. And at the end of that, then we use that goal along with our annual monitoring to determine how many antlerless permits ought to be issued. There are some people that think that we aren't counting deer right. There are some people that think we aren't issuing deer permits relative to where the population ought to be. There are people that think it's too high or it's too low. Mr. Chairman, members, I will assert that we will always have those disagreements, that things are not going right. But I will assure you that it is my intention to get us to a much better spot over the next 4 years with respect to deer populations, and also assert that deer populations will respond very quickly. And the fact that we were very, very conservative this year, it was the lowest harvest, as you all know, in decades, and we have a very favorable winter right now, the deer population will respond fairly quickly.
Commissioner, thank you for your insight on that. I want to remind you that you're the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, not the Commissioner of the Commerce Department, and need to worry about car accidents and deer. That's somebody else. And you're not the Commissioner of Agriculture and need to worry about how much corn the deer are eating. You need to worry about how many deer we have for the 500,000 deer hunters and all the people that enjoy venison. And so I know you're a big deer hunter. I know your family is. I appreciate that. And it was not you. It was one of your predecessors that I had a discussion with. There is no way that you can allow the taking of 5 antlerless deer on the shores of Lake Vermilion and think it's going to sustain. And unfortunately, we went down a path for a number of years where we did some really foolish management of deer in northern Minnesota. And it's not only your fault, but, and I've mentioned it to previous commissioners, you're the Commissioner of the Natural Resources, and let somebody else worry about deer collisions with cars and ag damage, and those discussions we can have elsewhere. As far as Representative Cornish and I are concerned, we can't have too many deer. So, and that's where we're coming from. And it's, if you're a deer hunter north of Highway 94, especially in far northeastern Minnesota, which I am one of, it's been extremely frustrating. But we have been through it before. And we come back, as we know, the deer that are left there are extremely good genetics, and we get a couple good winners, it'll make a difference. But I get frustrated when I hear people within the department worried about those other issues. I really think that's got a limited role in your department, and let somebody else advocate for that. Thank you. I don't know if you want to make a comment on that or if you think you need to get along with those commissioners better than you already do. Commissioner Landwehr.
Mr. Chair, my only two comments are that there's a popular notion that somehow the insurance company is putting pressure on us to reduce deer car collisions. That absolutely is not the case. I've never, ever once heard from an insurance company. And insurance companies don't care. I mean, they have more accidents, they charge more. They're just in the business of selling insurance. But from the standpoint of agricultural impacts, our field people do have to deal with that. And it is a real challenge for us when we have, especially in the winter, we have deer depredation on stored forage and so on. It becomes a real challenge. And I do think we have a responsibility there. And
Commissioner, we do, and we have programs to deal with those issues. And if we need to beef them up for whatever, as you know, that's a legitimate discussion to have. So thank you. Representative Deal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Commissioner, for your insight here on different things. I actually want to go back to the invasive species issue, the trailer sticker. So there's a lot of consternation over the fact that what is going to be the cost to the person. I've heard that the cost internally is $5. The DNR cost is $5. The question a lot of people are asking is, are the people taking the test going to be paying a fee? And there's a lot of information out there, and I guess I don't have a clear answer on that. Do you have a clear answer on that? Somebody's going to pay. There's no doubt about it. In fact, I suspect you've already paid for the software development. That's my first question.
Mr. Chairman, members, my understanding is the software, we're already on a hook for $500,000 for the program, so there is a cost of that. Since we are not going to go online right now, I can't tell you what the cost of the decal or the training would be, but we have to pay for that cost. I don't know if the cost was established in statute or if that is open for us, but I presume that if we were to go online, if nothing changed, if we were to go online July 1st with this system, there would be a cost to the applicant, and because it was in part intended to raise money for aquatic invasive species programs as well. So, Mr. Chairman, Representative, I do not know what the dollar price would have been.
Representative Deal.
Well, I think that you said if we were to go online July 1, this has to happen way before July 1. I know you realize that. Now, we went through the first time. I want to have a general statement on this idea. I mean, the Boundary Waters Lakes and the Voyageurs National Park Lakes. The Voyageurs National Park Lakes are already infested with rusty crayfish and with zebra mussel. And I want to say on the record that I've heard a fair amount from tourist operations who are just basically throwing a tizzy fit over this. You know, liken this to in Ontario when the government came and told us that each of our people that came to us to go out on the lake and operate a boat and a motor would have to have a license from the province of Ontario. Well, frankly, that was a formidable task, but we got ahead of that rather than behind it. And we put it on our website so that you could take the test. It's free on our website. You could take the test. You could come to our office and take the test. It was all about alcohol and life jackets. That was the major thrust of it. It wasn't something that could... that was insurmountable. When we went to sports shows, we talked to every guest about it. Before our guests came and brought their, in this instance, trailer into our state, we talked about our guests. We know as operators who is bringing what. And I just think that the resort communities and the resort operators should get out ahead of this. Now, that being said, one of the things that we have dealt with in this committee for some time is the, and Representative Hackbarth, Joe Cornish, our DFL members as well, and Representative McNamara have talked about having the software to track who are the bad guys. And so I'd like to have an update. We have funded that through this committee, and I'd like to have an update. And for those who don't know about this, this is an idea that someone is in Fairmont and they get a violation for anything, but let's talk invasive species. And then they go to Lake of the Woods in Baudette, and they launch, and they are sighted again. Well, we had no way to track that. There was no software. There was no communications. There was nothing. Now, what is the status of that, Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman,
Commissioner Langworth,
members, you're talking about what we call the records management system, and it is it's a tool that our enforcement officers will have. We're just rolling it out, frankly, and it is both software and hardware, but it will allow them, you know, in the field to identify a violator, find out what their most recent history has been, and if they're a repeat violator, we'll have that information available right there. So the records management system is going live right now. I don't believe Colonel Soaring is here, could give more detail, but when he comes up, Representative, he'll certainly be able to give you the insight on that. But that is a dramatic improvement over what we have had in the past, because we have not even had a sort of centralized database where an officer in International Falls could see what happened with an officer in Fairmont. And this will give them that virtually instantaneous capability.
Representative Deal.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner. Another thing that, you know, we're just a bit unclear, when there's a law, it requires enforcement. I mean, a law is a law, right? You can't violate the law. But there are times that when things are new, particularly like this, and you're running against a clock, and we're talking about rolling out software that hasn't been rolled out, and we're only a few months, let's call it, from the deadline to have this. How will, and maybe this is a question for Colonel Soaring, but what is going to be the philosophy of the department in that first summer of enforcement?
Commissioner Landwehr.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, of course, we don't publicize this, but the officers exercise a great deal of discretion when there's something new coming out, and you know, we don't want people to flaunt, you know, be scofflaws, but it's certainly when there's a new requirement or there information has not gotten out on it very well, officers exercise discretion. And you know, the best example I can give is when there was a state shutdown and people couldn't buy licenses, we tagged hardly anybody.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
thank you, Representative Dill.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, that is exactly what I'm worried about. I actually think that the department should have a position that is given to the conservation officers, and accept that someone violates this, and it's in the record system some way or another that it is just now getting going. I think we should have a position statewide with enforcement on this program particularly. And we've talked about this in the past where we've had particular things that were new, and different officers interpreted enforcement in different ways. And it's caused consternation amongst people statewide. And it's not that anyone had any wrong intentions. It's just that when somebody does something different, and then they get approached in another part of the state, and it's totally different than what happened in another part of the state, it makes our phones ring, which means that your phone rings. And I think it's just my opinion we should have something that is pretty well defined in these early months. I'm thinking that we may, based on the fact that there's a bill of repeal and the fact that you said that we're going to make some changes, it does seem that there needs to be some changes, but we maybe potentially should delay the effective date. It's just something unless something had happened quite soon. Because that I just did the St. Paul Sports Show for 4 days, and it's pretty well known that I'm a state legislator at those things, and people were at my booth rather than paying me money to go to fishing. They were more interested in their bow sticker. Last thing, Mr. Chairman, that I have right now is regarding the moose and the moose survey. Can you remind me of, and maybe this is for Mr. Bogus, can you remind me how we are doing a moose aerial survey each year, and I remember the indexes and the 90 percentile index and the plus or minus 10% and all that. At what level, can you remind us at what level we might consider after a few years of having a moose hunting in Minnesota?
Commissioner Landwehr.
Mr. Chairman, members, and Ed can correct me if I'm mistaken, we do an annual moose survey, an aerial survey of moose populations, and we're essentially looking for the number of bulls, the number of cows, the number of cows with calves, and so on. And it's a very detailed aerial survey that we do. And you can see on page 5 of that strategic plan, you can see what has happened with that population over time. Now, there's substantial, you know, this is a statistical derivation, a substantial error around that, or there's a confidence interval around that. So even though you see an uptick last year and you saw, you know, a dramatic increase from the previous year, we recognize that the confidence interval around that is broad enough that, you know, we can't say with great certainty that the population is actually increasing. It'll be very interesting to see what happens this year with respect to the population, see if that actually continues. But to your question about a season, as most of the members know, we canceled moose season 2 years ago. It was we'd had a moose season since the 1980s. Prior to that, we canceled it 2 years ago because of that precipitous decline. We have a moose management plan that was developed in conjunction with moose biologists around the state that had several triggers for when we would the state would cancel a moose season. So if the population dropped below a certain level, if the cow-calf ratio dropped below a certain level, if the number of bulls dropped below a certain level, there were certain triggers that if we had, if we were below those triggers for, I think it was 3 years in a row, we would cancel the moose season. We canceled moose season in the absence of hitting those triggers simply because it had dropped so quickly, so such a short amount of time. It had not been expected that it could drop that quickly, and we just felt that the only mortality factor that we had control over was the moose hunt, so we canceled the moose hunt. We were down to a pretty low level anyway at that point. We have talked generally about when we might reinstitute a moose hunt, and I'd offer there's two scenarios. One is the moose population could increase, and maybe this was some short-term decline, and we'll figure out, you know, what went wrong, and the population will increase, and we'll see that multiple-year increase, and that will trigger us to have a moose hunt. Or the moose population could stabilize or continue to decline. If it stabilizes, we may just have to get used to the notion this is kind of what we call the new normal. You know, maybe we're never going to have 10,000 moose again. Maybe 4,000 is the stable population we'll have forever. If the population stabilizes at whatever level, we can consider a harvest of some sort. But at this point in time, it hasn't stabilized. So we're still waiting, candidly, to see if the population goes up again, if it goes down, or what happens to it. In the short term, we're not at this point considering having another hunt.
Representative Dill, follow up.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you for the information.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, my question is related to AIS and enforcement. Now, I've had the opportunity a couple of times up by my lake home to witness cases where the watercraft inspectors have inspected boats that have been contaminated and everything else, some pretty egregious offenses and things. But it's my understanding that they, the watercraft inspectors, cannot find an individual. And then talking with them, they said, well, we have to call a CO. Maybe he's in Bemidji or whatever. A very unwieldy system. But yet our lakes and rivers are you know, in danger. Some people, in spite of everything that this committee's done and the DNR has done and all the publicity, some people still don't get it. And one boat can destroy, an entire lake. From an enforcement standpoint, has the DNR ever considered giving these watercraft inspectors at least some limited leeway in writing some fines for people that really don't care?
Mr. Landwehr.
Mr. Chairman, members, that would take a legislative change. We don't, the currently enforcement authorities only vested in certified peace officers, and even an administrative penalty would require a legislative change to do that. Our inspectors, you know, they're wonderful people. They're great people. These are summer jobs, so these are not sort of long-term, you know, highly trained professional people. They are oftentimes students, and they're oftentimes, you know, still in college and looking for a professional career. So we give them a lot of training. We certainly teach them how to inspect boats, how to help people identify infractions and do that. But they're not of the level I would offer to really be thinking about even issuing a ticket or a fine. So one of the things that we can do that helps us in that a little bit more is they don't have to call just conservation officer. They can call any certified peace officer. And so we often, in many cases, have a delegation agreement with a local unit of government, a city or a county. And so the police or the sheriff are oftentimes available as well, and they may even have a city or county boat inspector from that delegation agreement that has a more direct access than we might have to a conservation officer.
Follow-up, Representative Ugelman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the watercraft inspectors, what would be the procedure there? Do they just crank out their cell phone and call, for instance, in Leech Lake's case, the Walker PD? Or, I mean, do they know this? Is that what they're doing? Have you had a lot of instances where this has been the case?
Commissioner Landwehr.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the most part, they are doing inspections. They are certainly observing when there are violations, but if there's a violation, they're going to go and help remedy that. They're going to make the boat into compliance. So after they have done an inspection, they have found, say, a weed hanging off it with a zebra mussel, they're going to take it off. So the boat is no longer in violation, and there's not any sense to call an officer at that point.
Follow-up, Representative Ugelman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, Representative Dill talked about multiple offenders and people that perhaps don't take this very seriously. And I know I, for one, would like to see that we take enforcement very seriously on this. And it seems to me it's very unwieldy. And I agree that, you know, if somebody's got a small little amount of weed on their boat, that they probably shouldn't be fined, but obviously notified. But there are, I witnessed one incident where the individual was very belligerent to the watercraft inspector, and she could not do a single thing. It's kind of, we have to take this seriously, and people have had the time now to know about this. I think it's time to crack down and give our people the tools they need to protect our lakes. Thank you.
To this point, Representative Cornish.
Just a quick clarification, Representative Ugelman. We had, this has been actually talked about years ago, and the problem that you addressed, people turning belligerent, is the very reason that we don't want the water inspectors doing it, because these people, from experience, they're on vacation, and you talk to them about a boat, you hold them up at the access, it can turn real ugly fast, and then these folks don't have any of the tools to deal with that, and it would take a legislative change. And it's the same reason we went to, from the CVI, is checking semis on the road, we went to uniformed officers, more of that, because the confrontational aspect of it, so it would be a tough one.
It is a tough issue, but Commissioner, my experience with it, they're good people at the landings, and when they run into problems, generally speaking, as you said, they're college students interested in the arena. Most of them have smartphones. They're smart enough to know maybe they can sneak a picture of that boat and let the local, in our case, Crow Wing County Sheriff, know who can get there oftentimes quicker than the conservation officer, but we need to take it serious. And Representative Ugelman, you're right that these people that take their boat from Minnetonka and then whip up to Mille Lacs or whip up to Gull Lake and think they can just fly around and not have to care is unfortunate. And that's why Representative Dill's work on getting the COs the good tools so they know that this guy was actually warned, or this gal was actually warned on Prior Lake this morning, and he's at the landing on Leech right now. They're going to have that tool, Representative Cornish's people aren't going to take that situation lightly, which they shouldn't. But unfortunately, as sad as it is, some folks still just don't know, I'm supposed to have my boat plug out. It's frustrating for us, but it's still the reality. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Ugelman, when you were talking about a little weed on the boat, I thought you were getting into a different subject area, but wasn't sure where we were going there. But
it was a medical
condition. Okay. I want to go into a little different topic area. Wasn't able to attend the Pheasant Summit, and I know there's been articles back and forth. I'm a little unclear on what exactly comes out of that, or what the department's position is. And I'm thinking back to what Representative McNamara said about Commissioner of Natural Resources, and it's not just Commissioner of Game. You have the responsibility for wildlife and the resource. So pheasants are game, but there's pollinators and other things that we don't shoot. that are part of the natural resource and they're part of the wildlife. And so what exactly is the DNR's position and proposal for dealing with the pheasant issue and maybe the associated pollinator issue?
Commissioner Landwehr.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you very much for that question, because that's a subject near and dear to my heart. The governor, of course, convened the roundtable. The governor's, you know, if the governor wanted to know what I thought about how to improve pheasants, he would have just asked me. The governor wanted to hear from, you know, 300 Minnesotans what they thought we ought to do about pheasants. So first and foremost, it was sort of a summit intended to get the ideas of, you know, the population at large about what we ought to do. And I want to keep reminding that about people, because I can tell you what we can do for pheasants. And the most gratifying thing is that the information, the ideas that came from the 300 people who attended were very consistent with what we need to do for pheasants. And, you know, bottom line is it's habitat. You know, we have to have habitat for pheasants, and that has to be nesting habitat in the form of grass. It has to be winter habitat in the form of cattail sloughs and cover plantings, and it has to be winter food. And those, you know, we've known this for a long, long time, and that knowledge ultimately helped lead to, I believe, the CRP. If you think back to the prior 1985, Dr. Al Berner was in our Medelia Wildlife Office, was a big critic of federal farm policy at the time, because it created this boom and bust situation. We had a 3-year set aside at the time, and it was actually harmful to pheasants, because you would establish cover, you know, 1 year, and you'd be plowing it up 2 years later. And so a lot of the discussion was happening among wildlife biologists at the time was, how do we create a longer program such that there can be some long-term value? And out of that really grew the Conservation Reserve Program, CRP Program, and the Wetlands Reserve Program, both of which had some really deep roots in Minnesota. When you look at the graph of pheasants, I don't know that it's in this book, we had a serious decline from the 70s to early 1980. And I can remember going out in 1984, and we felt lucky to see a pheasant track. Huge decline in the 1985 harvest was one of the lowest on record. 1985 Farm Bill passed. 1986 we started seeing CRP on the ground. We had 1.9 million acres of CRP at one point in time shortly after that. Much of that in southern Minnesota. And when you look at the pheasant population, it just responds phenomenally. It is a direct correlation between the amount of acres of CRP in the pheasant range and the pheasant population. And we had fairly good pheasant populations. I'm going to get to the other ones in a moment, Representative. We had fairly good pheasant populations up till about 2010. And 2010, we started losing CRP ground faster than we could replace it. And so today we're at about 1.1 million acres. So we have lost 800,000 acres of CRP relative to our peak. At the same time, the protocol for prioritizing CRP went from let's take the most erodible land out of production, that's what the 1985 Farm Bill did, to let's put CRP in the cheapest place possible. So I remember the day when we used to go down to Stewartville, down to Rochester area, and hunt pheasants, and there were pheasants all over the place because there was CRP all over the place. By 1995, that CRP had left southern Minnesota and gone to northwestern Minnesota. So most of our CRP right now is in northwest Minnesota, still providing a lot of good benefits. Some of those benefits we'll talk about in a minute, but it's not in pheasant country. So the pheasant population has taken a big hit as a result of that. Now, the Pheasant Summit said, well, let's really focus on three things: public lands, private lands, and hunting opportunities. And by public land, one of the things that came out loud and clear was we have requirements for both roadsides and for buffers, riparian buffers. Those are more or less public lands that we ought to be optimizing the habitat value of, as well as wildlife management areas, waterfowl production areas. Secondly, we need to work on more private lands. Let us make the conservation programs cost competitive for private lands so we can keep those private lands in habitat. And thirdly, let's make sure that there are places for people to go hunt pheasants. And so those are all general ideas that are coming out of the Pheasant Summit that we are going to represent at the roundtable on Friday, but then get a steering committee together to help us figure out implementation. The reason we need a steering committee is because fundamentally for those programs, the department does not have any authority. We don't do work on private lands in the state. That's the prerogative of the Board of Water and Soil Resources. We don't administer the enforcement of shoreland zoning or roadside programs. We do provide hunting opportunities. That's the one thing that we have. But we need
Board of Water and Soil Resources, we need the Department of Agriculture, we need the Pollution Control Agency as, and the federal government as partners in pulling together the implementation of that, because we have to work through others in order to get that work done. Now, the broader responsibilities, absolutely. The pheasant is one species that comes off a grassland. It's not even a native species. But as I've been quoted as saying, it is a canary in the coal mine. You know, as the pheasant goes, so goes the Poweshiek skipper. As the pheasant goes, so goes the badger. So goes the cottontail rabbit. So goes every species that depends on grasslands and wetlands is going to have the same face, the same fate as a pheasant is as those grasslands disappear. And so, as we are looking at what we need to do to increase pheasants, we're going to be looking as well to how do we make sure that that habitat that we put on the ground really does provide those other benefits, and that is to pollinators, and that's to all these non-game species, and it is to water quality, because water quality problems that we see arising in agricultural areas tend to be as a result of either erosion and sedimentation or from loss of nutrients. And grass, not the boating kind, but grass, can keep all that stuff in place. So again, we need to have all of the agencies working together to get this stuff delivered on the ground. The department's role in this is going to be largely collaborative and motivational, but I do believe we've got a lot of attention focused right now on this, and I'm optimistic that we'll have some successes.
Follow-up, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I've been here 10 years, and you've been in this business for a long time, and we keep dancing around the difficulties, and I'm concerned that the outcome that comes from this is the push is back to the simplest thing, and that's a transaction that we just, that Representative Torkelson puts $5 or $10 million into buying more land for wildlife management areas, and we declare victory, and that's it. And that isn't going to be enough. We are not going to be able to buy our way out of this situation. I think he's getting the $10 million out right now, but so it takes a change in behavior, and we've put over since the legacy event, we're putting a lot of money into buffers, voluntary buffers, and I know, and I think most of the folks in the room know, that we have a high demand for that. We need more money in there for that. But again, that's the public investment into the situation. I think you're on the right track when you're talking about road ditches, because they belong to the public. They're being mowed in June and July. They're being planted in May in many places. So a simple thing of trying to look at those, I would hope we can find a consensus on that, for people seeing the value and not doing that and providing the habitat. But we didn't get in this situation in the short term, but what you've mentioned about CRP is about the public dollar and the will to invest in public support for soil erosion, water quality, or wildlife. And that ebbs and flows. And the will to buy ebbs and flows as well. So meanwhile, we have changes going on in the landscape, changes going on in the public, and we end up at this situation. I think it took us, we've had three or four CARP summits in the last 5 years, and we'll probably have some others. And we're still dealing with that. So I know at least on... I can speak, I think, pretty good for our side that we want to keep working on this and try to be helping out and realize this is a very difficult issue. But I know I hear from people that they want some action, and they want something more than what it's been of just let's buy our way there, because I don't think that's going to be enough. And it's a simple thing to say, well, we can measure X number of acres, we can measure X number of miles, but... If we're down to 50,000 hunters and they're getting X number of pheasants, that's a measurement tool as well. And I think right now the mark of public dollars is like this, and the number of pheasant hunters and pheasants is like this. So something's not working and we're willing to try to figure this out.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Commissioner, to the pheasants, I think it was in this morning's Star Trip, I think Dennis Anderson had an article, and I thought, wow, I don't even know if I got the average. I think there was 50-some thousand pheasant hunters and 169,000 pheasants, so I thought, well, that's just a little over three each, and I had to reminisce to think, and I'm not still sure that I can say for sure that I got my average, and that's kind of sad. I think there's a couple things. On the roadsides, Representative Hansen alluded to, I think, a real problem with MnDOT's policies. There's some lands, unfortunately, in Minnesota that are not owned by the road authority. They're easements, and those owners of those lands are allowed to hay them outside of what we think is appropriate time frame to hay them. So I'm interested in working with your agency and getting that changed. I think it's going to take some legislative change, maybe some financial incentive also to those people, but we have to quit mowing the road ditches. I want to clarify the policy MnDOT has in regards to interchanges and areas where they use for safety purposes the mowing alongside the roadway. Sometimes they get up on the back slopes, which is totally inappropriate. So I think the roadsides, there are some things we can do. Along that, I would identify buffers, working with the ag community to get some better buffers along some of the drainage and streams that would be good for water quality and such. So I'm really interested in those. Commissioner, I do want your department to come forward with an aggressive plan to get rid of brome grass in WMAs and push the feds to get rid of it in the WPAs. It's embarrassing the quality of grass we have in some of our public, what often are referred to as our public hunting lands, that are still in brome, which with a little bit of snow is of no quality out on the landscape compared to a good native prairie reestablishment that has good pollinator habitat and fantastic deer, pheasant, and bunny rabbit habitat. Representative Fabian to this point. Okay, thank you. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, from northern Minnesota, and we are experiencing a huge loss of land up there to the state. And it's causing a real problem with our property tax base. It's causing a problem with young people being able to afford to even own property up there. And my question for you today is, first of all, thank you for this plan. I've been paging through it. It's a lot of stuff in here that I was looking for. But one thing I don't see in here is, what is your plan for the amount of property that you think is sufficient for the state or the DNR to own?
Commissioner Landwehr.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representatives. There's the state land ownership. Pattern of state land ownership right now, of course, and I want to reiterate, it's owned by the state. It's not owned by the DNR. We administer it. Much of the land that the state owns is simply because nobody else wanted it. And you know, I want to identify the consolidated conservation lands that are 1.3 million acres somewhere in that vicinity were deeded back to the state because the bonds that were sold to originally drain those were in default, and the counties were virtually in default. As a result, the state made the counties whole, assumed those lands, you know, decades and decades ago. We started out with 8 million acres of school trust lands once upon a time. We're down to 2.5 million acres now. We have sold off 5.5 million acres of that, but that was 2.5 million acres given to the state to establish a K-12 education system. The remaining lands that are there, a million of those acres are peatlands that simply don't have any market value. The million and a half that are left are medium to high quality timber and mineral lands that the state is managing for the benefit of the trust. There are other wildlife areas, for instance, the Rosa River Wildlife Area, even the Thief Lake Wildlife Area, I believe, are lands that were deemed not suitable for public private use and were conveyed to the state for establishment as public hunting grounds. So many of the lands that are out there right now are out there by virtue of either nobody else wanting them or the state getting something as an asset for state purposes. There are still public lands being acquired today, but I would offer, I believe most of those are in southern Minnesota, not much in northern Minnesota. The lands that are being acquired today are, you know, similar to the ones that we were just talking about. They're lands primarily to provide habitat and hunting opportunities for pheasants.
and they're being purchased under the Wildlife Management Area Citizen Advisory Plan that the department worked with citizens a decade ago to develop. Outside of that, there aren't any sort of master plans on what should be the state forest complement, what should be the state forest complement primarily, which is most of the public lands.
Representative Green, one point I wanted to make along the line of your questioning, which are good ones. When we hear the Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Bill and the LCCMR bill, we've let those folks know we want them to not only tell us about how much land they're interested in buying, but geographically where is that land that they're proposing to buy. So in other words, how much is in counties of high state ownership already? Representative Green, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. And I appreciate that answer, and I understand that there are properties out there that have no commercial value, but there in our area, to say that there's not a problem with buying up land that does have commercial use is simply not the case in our area. And we will be talking about Lessard Sam's recommendation here shortly, too. But in one of my counties right now, if the recommendations go through, we stand to lose another 2,000 acres in one of the poorest counties in Minnesota. And all up into the northwest area, I can take you to every county and show you productive cropland or productive forest land that is being purchased by the state. And so my question was, and maybe you don't have an answer for it, is how much is enough, you know, what is enough? When will you reach the point, or will you reach the point where you say, you know, the state owns enough property, we have no property tax base left, and the people have a right to property ownership as opposed to being a tenant of the state?
Commissioner, can I ask you to preface Representative Green's answer in the point that are you being aggressive enough in northern Minnesota in selling land that can be turned back? I think that's truthfully the answer to the challenge, because Representative Cornish and I get really nervous when we begin to talk about not buying land in southern Minnesota that we need to protect and buy. But I also don't think the department's aggressive enough in northern Minnesota. So if you could address Representative Green's point. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members, this is a very, we could spend a lot of time talking about this, but I want to address specifically your question, Representative Green. The department is using what we call a strategic land asset management process right now. We're going county by county throughout northern Minnesota. As I mentioned, much of the lands that the state owns right now are very disconnected, and they're scatterboard, checkerboard. I think Senator Saxhart has used in the past, by virtue of how those lands were transferred to the state. The SLAM process, Strategic Land Asset Management process, we sit down with the county in particular, and we look at what the county has in ownership, what the state has in ownership, and we say, okay, collectively, what can we do to exchange lands such that, first off, it makes more sense for the lands that we're holding so that we have manageable pieces, so we don't have that isolated authority that is providing no benefit, so that we can do exchanges with the county so that, first off, that we've optimized the holdings of the two, but also so that we can identify those tracts that really don't provide strategic value to the state and we sell them. So we have actually undertaken, and Representative Fabian knows this, especially in northern Minnesota, we have undertaken some efforts in many counties now. We had, the first year I was a commissioner, we had an opportunity to come in with Roseau County to talk about an exchange and a sale program. We've had a subsequent sale program each year. And so we are looking at non-strategic land holdings and selling them. With respect to, you know, how much will the state acquire, you know, I think you all will know, and I think Representative McNamara just said this, citizens of the state of Minnesota want the state to acquire land. And so we do that, and it's wildlife management areas in southern Minnesota, it's public water accesses in northern Minnesota, it's public state forests in some cases, but recognizing that the impact can be great on northern counties in particular, I think there are two things to keep in mind. One is that we've also looked at trying to get those public benefits that people want, like public access, by virtue of buying easements. And so prior to my arrival here, the state purchased an easement for 188,000 acres of Blandon land that provides for public access on those lands because they are first and foremost private lands, and Blandon could close those lands to access at any time. And more recently, one of the remaining large landowners in the state, Molpus, has threatened to do that very thing. And so we have been trying to provide what the public wants, which is public access, by looking at alternative methods besides buying land outright. But the other and final observation I'd make, Mr. Chairman, with respect to, you know, what does that do to tax base, I certainly understand that by virtue of being in state ownership, you're not going to put a convenience store there. But the legislature adjusted the payment in lieu of tax payments to the counties, I believe it was 2 years ago now, and the payment rate right now is really quite high. I think in many cases it exceeds what would be the property tax value. So I think you'll find that some counties are quite satisfied with the payment they're getting, and that hopefully is intended to offset the loss to counties by that property tax revenue.
Follow-up, Representative Green.
Thank you. Just a comment, I guess, because we could go back and forth on this all day, I guarantee you. As far as the counties being involved, I will tell you that in my area, even in the new recommendations that's coming, it is recommended that they don't even seek the county's approval. The county's not involved at all in these land purchases. And as far as the people wanting the state to acquire land, I can just about guarantee you I could fill this room with people in northern Minnesota who say the state owns already too much land in our area.
Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you, Commissioner, for being here. I'm going to kind of take off a little bit from where Representative Green has been. I somewhat have to challenge your statement. You said you don't have plans to buy more land. I'm looking in the book here, the parklands, the Aspen parklands and the red areas in the north in my district, Kitson County, Roseau County, Marshall County, Pennington County. There seems to be a plan in place to acquire more land up there. And to Representative Green's comments, when I go home and talk to people, this is probably the number one issue that we talk about. The state of Minnesota and other agencies owning land. All four of the county commissions that I represent have no net gain policies in place. You were correct, Commissioner, there have been some land sales. You know, I brought you the map of Marshall County 4 years ago when I first got down here of the checkerboard effect in Marshall County. You and I flew over that area one day when we flew up to northwest Minnesota with Governor Dayton. The legislative auditor's report from 2010 talks about more work is needed to address the inefficient checkerboard pattern of state forest and ownership in northern Minnesota. You talked about the payments for PILT in the acquired lands. If I own a piece of property and the state of Minnesota owns a piece of property immediately adjacent to me, I'm probably paying $10 an acre on that. The state of Minnesota may be paying $1.37. Members and Commissioner, we have got to tackle this. I talked about this on the floor last spring when we were debating the legacy amendment. We are using $100 million to buy state land, and we are biting off of fiscal responsibility to make the PILT payments and to maintain the lands. And we're not using legacy funds to do that, and we're putting more and more pressure on the general fund, and it is not sustainable. We have how many years of the legacy left?
20
years left. $100 million a year, something like that. You have to have some empathy for the tax base and the people of the northwest Minnesota, northern Minnesota. AMC, the Association of Minnesota Counties, I'm told, passed a resolution with only two counties voting against it for no net gain throughout the state. Now, I am not opposed to purchasing more land in southern Minnesota and so forth, but we have to address the critical need, and I appreciate the strategic land asset management, but I've been hearing about that, Commissioner, for a long time. Some of these things need to be expedited. We need to find ways to make this more timely. The value of some of these small parcels, the checkerboards in Marshall County and Roseau County, is extremely high. I mean, those things are worth $1,000 an acre. And you know, we could put a cabin there, and all of a sudden it improves tax base for our schools, our townships, our counties, everybody that's involved in property taxes. So, folks, I'm asking that we have a serious discussion about really what is the goal of this. And listen, I'm a hunter, I'm a fisherman, I love the outdoors. I've invited the commissioner up to my place to go fishing. He's going to bring an aquatic invasive species sticker to put on my trailer. But, you know, more of a comment than anything else. But, Commissioner, I do want to know more as we go forward on really, are we doing something here to address the serious concerns of county commissions and school districts around the state of Minnesota that are really severely impacted by the 30% of my district is owned by the state. You go over to Representative Dill's district, and it's a lot more than that. Lake of the Woods County, 70% of Lake of the Woods County is in is in public hands. And I appreciate that people from Rochester and St. Paul and all those places want these things available to them in northern Minnesota, but the reality is that northern Minnesotans have about filled up. So there's my little deal for today.
Commissioner, can I just add to Representative Fabian's point, and both last year Chairman Dill and Chairman Kahn mentioned their interest in visiting the PILT discussion in the land acquisition in Lessard, Sams, and LCCMR. I've heard from the townships, the cities, and the counties. They're very much interested in visiting that issue. I've discussed it with Representative Wagenius. I think we're going to have a great discussion in this committee about when you move into a bigger home, I use the analogy, and you now have a bigger heat bill and a bigger roof to replace someday, is it appropriate that your neighbors pay for your additional heat bill and your additional shingles you're going to have to buy someday? We're going to have that discussion that should Lessard Sams, if they're buying land, make some arrangements, payments, and not expect the general fund to pay that in PILT. I think to Representative Green's point, it answers the question then, when is enough enough? Because you're held harmless. If you're going to buy land, you've already made the payment to the local units of government, and then they can be indifferent to it, at least in the discussion of their losing money when they're doing what oftentimes is looked at a good thing and the right thing to do. So we're going to have a great discussion on that. Commissioner, I want to allow you an answer if you have some points to make to represent Fabian's point, and then Representative Dill had a point to this point. Commissioner Landrick?
Mr. Chairman, members, you all know this is not a new discussion. This is, we have a discussion virtually every year about, you know, what's the appropriate role for the state in terms of land ownership and how do you deal with the impact of local units of government. And, you know, we do what you direct us to do. So certainly I'm an advocate for protecting vital natural resources. I think they're critical to the quality of life of the state. I understand they have a local impact. That's why we also support the payment of low tax structure. But end of the day, you know, I spend the money you give me.
Commissioner, we're actually interested in getting some things done over the next 2 years, so we look forward to working with you, and this is one issue that I think we're going to be able to work on because it's going to be a challenge for the next 20 years with the legacy funding and the perpetual money in LCCMR for land acquisition potentially or easements or restorations, things like that. Representative Dill.
As you said, Mr. Chairman, you took most of what I said away.
Sorry.
It's a very good point. I really feel that over the years here between the two parties, we've really come to a bit of a bipartisan understanding of what the problem is, with the, particularly with the passage of the Lessard Amendment, and that there has to be that recognition you talked about to the counties or to the local units of government that have the land inserted into their county for the public good. And we have yet to find that. And I think it's not the commissioner's fault. He said it. We spend the money that we got. In fact, the money that pays the bill for those lands, whether it be Lessard or whatever, I think that, that Representative Fabian said it's a general fund obligation, which competes with our schools and our nursing homes and our higher education and a variety of things like that. That doesn't really make sense to me. And so rather than dwell on it, I think that the new members have to know there's a lot of history here in the last decade about trying to get to a point where we recognize the problem of the funding. The last thing is, Representative Fabian talked about percentage of ownership. I don't have any counties that are less than 60. I don't represent four. I don't have any that are less than 60% publicly owned, and I have one county that's 90.7% publicly owned, an entire county in the Arrowhead of Minnesota. So it also has the high, that particular county with only about 9.5% of the land public has the highest property value per capita in the entire state, courtesy of the condos and homes along the north shore of Lake Superior. It also has the lowest tax rate for real estate in the entire state, and it trades every other year or so with one of the counties in the center of the state over by Brainerd. But yet we can afford to build a school that would look like a palatial palace because that seasonal recreational would pay for that, but we can't afford for to buy grocery bags to put the covers on the books to protect them because the same people don't pay on the operating, and it's not in the jurisdiction of this committee. But it's such a complicated problem, and the more we get public land involved, the more it becomes a bigger problem yet, and that's the reason that we are just absolutely dire to get a solution.
Thank you. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So DNR covers the whole state, including the urban area. And I was noticing on your trends here, the four key trends, one of you said one of them is that the population is urbanizing, diversifying, and aging. And so I'd like to have you talk a little bit more about the urban investment and involvement of the DNR. Both, you know, what's going on with our recreational areas that you're involved in, our pollinator issues. People in the committee know that one of the things I'm very interested in terms of pollinators is not only what we grow in terms of our urban forest and all that, but also some of the urban agriculture that's going on there. But could you just talk a little bit more about what the investment is in terms of urban DNR activity? And I know from looking through here, you also recognize that we have a diverse population growing. I think 181% increase in Latino and in the Latino population expected. And I think that you're trying to recognize that in some way. So maybe you could address those two issues, like what the investment is and some of the issues in our urban parks in particular, and also the diversifying workforce, how you're dealing with that.
Commissioner Landwehr.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for that question. And I'm going to be talking off the top of my head, so some of my numbers might not be correct, but I'm going to focus on the seven-county metro area rather than say Minneapolis and St. Paul, because we are a metro area. And so I'm going to think of it from two standpoints. What is the asset that we own? What is the asset the state of Minnesota owns, the department administers, and what are the programs that we offer? And so when you look at the asset, there's some 40,000 acres of land in the Seven County metro area that's owned by the state. And so Carlos Avery is a good example. The Minnesota River State area is another example. We have, I believe it's three state parks, Fort Snelling, William O'Brien, Afton State Parks. We have somewhere in the neighborhood of, I want to say, 60 public water accesses in the metro area. I think we've got 110 miles of snowmobile corridors. We have a large footprint in terms of asset. Obviously, the local units of government have probably more of an asset than we do in many respects, but we do have a large asset value there. One of the assets I want to mention is associated with Fort Snelling. That's the upper bluff of Fort Snelling, upper post of Fort Snelling, right next to the International Airport. There's a historic site up there, and you have all driven by it many times. You've seen the old bunkhouses for the troops up there. The state owns that, 140 acres. We're trying to redevelop that, perhaps as an outdoor skills building area for metro residents. We've got the asset. The programming we've got, more and more we're trying to get the pipeline going of urban people into outdoor recreation, because the concern is that the more urban we get, the less outdoor recreation people are involved with. And we want to make sure that the programming is there that brings them in. So we have launched a number of programs under what I call the I Can series. We've got an I Can Camp, I Can Climb, I Can Fall Off Rocks programs, where we really hold people's hands and get them out. But a number of the programming opportunities like that is really what we're doing now, trying to get people into the outdoor recreation experience.
Representative Clark, a quick follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there any investment in the parks themselves and in this whole pollinator issue? Have you been looking at that too? It's one of my
follow-ups. Mr. Chairman, members of the
legislature
gave us, I believe it was $300,000 last year, to actually do pollinator habitat work on existing state lands. And we are actively doing that across all of our land holdings. And as you mentioned, with respect to investment in parks, we also are going to have a grand opening this year on the Browns Creek Valley Trail from Stillwater to the East Metro. We've got a number of additional projects going up, so there are investments going into some of these parks and trails as well.
Thank you. Just
a comment. Thank you for that. And Mr. Chairman, one of the other points you make in here is that people have less vacation days, so from more than 5 to less than 4 now. And a lot of our urban people maybe can't go up to some of the other wonderful recreation areas that we have in parts of Minnesota. So that kind of investment right at home is important. I just want to support that. Thank
you. And Representative Clark, I would encourage you to come out to my district, to Afton State Park, and see the new pollinator habitat and stay in one of the camper cabins that I was chief author to get out there. So I would encourage you to stay in the metro and enjoy the great outdoors sometimes. So
thank you. How long a waiting list is there for those cabins, I wonder?
The DNR would be able to tell you that, but there is a waiting list for the prime times for sure.
Thank you.
Last question from Representative Heinzman, then we're going to move on. Representative Heinzman.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Commissioner, I probably should ask this question earlier. It might take a little bit of time to try and answer it. Maybe it's a quick one. We'll see what happens. I represent the Brainerd Lakes area. And prior to my serving here, I also served on a local watershed district board. We have been looking at the possibility of doing some shallow lake restoration. And in the context of the way the DNR has viewed that in the past, in most cases it was in reference to bringing back a rice bed of some kind of that sort. But I've also seen an interest locally, as you've seen more and more lakes become more shallow as there's sedimentation that's happening. We're losing some recreational value on numerous lakes in my district. I'm wondering, as I approach DNR locally on this issue, I was informed that there's really not a lot of interest in doing anything in that way to try to bring back that recreational value. Is that information accurate? And if not, why is it that we can't give watershed districts and counties some more access in terms of permitting to do that kind of work?
Commissioner Landwehr?
Mr. Chairman, members, just for clarification, are you talking about dredging?
Representative Heinzman.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Commissioner, yeah, in whatever would restore that depth in these cases where we have a sedimentation issue. So some folks refer to it as dredging.
Commissioner Landwehr.
Mr. Chairman, members, and to be clear, the shallow lakes work that we do typically is on lakes that are sort of naturally shallow, and they get infested with carp, and we want to kill the carp and allow the wildlife habitat to come back. The department doesn't typically get involved with dredging projects. The protected waters law gives the department the authority to issue permits for doing dredging projects, and certainly those happen. In fact, I think it was the LaSard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council provided funds to the city of Albert Lea, if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Chairman, to actually do a dredging project on a lake. The bottom line is it's extraordinarily expensive. I think it was $4 million for 300 acres, which, do the math, is more than $10,000 an acre to do that type of work.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Heinzman, I would encourage you to talk offline on that subject. Members, a couple things. Staff will put in your packet to save both of these if you happen to leave them there. If you want to take I'm referring to the conservation agenda of the DNR. Some of you may want to take it back to your office, but I encourage you to keep it. And the PowerPoint needs to be put in your save because Assistant Commissioner Meyer will be picking up tomorrow morning where the commissioner left off. Thank you, Commissioner, for being there. Meeting's adjourned.